Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello and welcome to the ID the Future podcast. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting from Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. We have on the show with us today Dr. Granville Sewell, professor of mathematics at the University of Texas, El Paso. Dr. Sewell completed his PhD in mathematics at the age of 23 at Purdue University and has subsequently been employed by a number of universities, including the Universidad Simon Bolivar in Caracas, Venezuela, Oak Ridge National Laboratory, Purdue University, IMSL Incorporated in Houston, the University of Texas, El Paso, the University of Texas Center for High Performance Computing, and Texas A&M University. So, Dr. Sewell, thank you very much for coming on the show with us today.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Now, Dr. Sewell, the reason we're having you on is because you are author of a recent book out by Discovery Institute Press titled In the Beginning and Other Essays on Intelligent Design. And I want to say first that as I read your book while preparing for this podcast, I found it to be an incredibly enjoyable read, and it was full of stimulating thought experiments. I'm not just saying that. You know, I read a lot of books on this issue. Some are far more fun and interesting to read than others. I'd like to ask you just a preliminary question before we get in too much about the book, but why did you decide to write this book?
Okay, well, thanks for your compliments. I've actually been working on this book for over 30 years, at least some of the material was written 30 years ago. I've been basically your typical ID theorist for 30 years now, saying basically the same things. For example, the book includes a little letter to the editor of the Purdue newspaper written 31 years ago, arguing that intelligent design is legitimate science. I didn't use the term intelligent design, but that's what it said. And I had an appendix to a 1985 reference book about my software program that discussed irreducible complexity. Again, not by name. I never heard the term until Behe's book in 1996, but that's certainly what it was about. So this is a topic that I've been reading and writing about for many years. And until the last 10 years, it wasn't possible to publish anything with this point of view. So it's nice to see the direction things are going and that a book like this can be published, finally.
Well, we're certainly thankful for this book, and it's clearly something that in many ways represents some of your life's work. I know you've obviously done a lot of different academic activities in your career, but this is certainly one component of your scholarship and scientific writing. And so we are honored to be able to publish it here with Discovery Institute Press. In your opening essay of In the Beginning, you discuss some cosmological evidence for a finite universe. So I'd like to ask you about this, Dr. Sewell. What do you feel are some of the more compelling lines of evidence that the universe indeed did have a beginning and that it is not infinitely old?
Well, first, the Big Bang Theory is not controversial, unlike some of the other topics we're going to talk about today. It certainly was controversial 50 years ago, but it's pretty much accepted by all physicists just about. And so the evidence obviously must be very strong. I outlined the usual evidence, the expanding universe, the cosmic background radiation. The book even includes a little model for the normalized size of the universe, which shows the singularity at the beginning of time. It's actually based on the Newtonian gravitational theory rather than general theory of relativity, but it's the same equations. You know, I've outlined the standard evidence. It's pretty much accepted.
You have a great quote, Dr. Sewell, from Steven Weinberg in your book, where the staunchly materialist physicist says that modern cosmology's adherence to a finite universe, quote, is a tribute to the essential objectivity of modern astrophysics, and that this consensus has been brought about not by shifts in philosophical preference or by the influence of astrophysical mandarins, but by the pressure of the empirical data. What does it say to you when even those philosophically opposed to a beginning are forced to believe in one?
Well, it says that the evidence finally trumped philosophical considerations, and I think I know where you're going with this. That's exactly what's happening now in biology. All the Herculean efforts to ignore the evidence are finally failing, just like they did in the evidence for the Big Bang was so overwhelming that it overcame the philosophical objections to it, and I believe that's what's going to eventually happen in discussion of biological evolution.
So why were scientists originally so angry about the evidence for a non-eternal universe?
Because it points out the incompleteness of science. There were no natural causes before nature came into existence. So basically, we're here because of some supernatural act, whether by an intelligent or unintelligent forces. It's supernatural by definition because there's no way we can ever discover the causes.
Now, Dr. Sewell, you write in your book that, quote, many scientists still tend to think of religions as systems of beliefs which have no root in science and of atheism as the absence of any such unprovable beliefs. The truth is that now all theories of origins, theistic or atheistic, involve speculation as to the nature of the supernatural force which created our universe out of nothingness because there was no natural causes before nature came into existence. The question is only, was it an intelligent or unintelligent supernatural force that created time, space, matter, and energy out of nothingness? Unquote. I love your point here because in my view, it reflects the fact that at the base of all worldviews is some uncaused cause that generated the universe with all of its order and complexity. So what, in your view, is the best candidate for that uncaused cause, an intelligent or an unintelligent force?
Well, if you just look at the universe and exclude the Earth, the rest of the universe, that would be a harder question. But if you look at the Earth and what's happened here, the appearance and development of life and humans, intelligence, to me that settles the question for any reasonable person that it must have been intelligent forces, but not so much from the Big Bang itself or the rest of the universe. It's the order and complexity of life in biology that settles this question.
Let's turn now to some of the anthropic principles and the fine-tuning evidence you discuss in your book. You make a great point that a materialist might respond to the evidence for fine-tuning by arguing that perhaps different conditions in the universe would just dictate different forms of life. But I think that your retort is excellent, and you say, quote, however, we're not talking about conditions which are hostile to life as we know it on Earth, but rather conditions so hostile that any imaginable form of life would be impossible, unquote. I assume that you're talking about conditions that would exist in most universes where, say, if there isn't any matter, or there are no elements more complex than, say, lithium, or there's no way for covalent bonds to form between atoms, or matter is spread out too thin to form stars or planets, then how on Earth are you going to have life? And it's really impossible to imagine life in a universe without covalent bonds. So is that the kind of argument that you have in mind here?
Yes, and again, it's important to remember that the science in this second chapter about the fine-tuning is not controversial or new, and certainly not original with me. This is not something that ID theorists go around pushing and the rest of the scientific world pushes back. This is all based on published articles in physics textbooks, so the fine-tuning is not controversial at all, and it's well known that we're not talking about conditions that would be hostile to life as we know it on Earth, but conditions so hostile that any imaginable form of life would be impossible. For example, if any of the basic constants of nature were slightly changed, conditions would result that would not support any imaginable forms of life. For example, no stable atoms, no hydrogen and helium, no stars, only stars that burn out very quickly and so forth. I actually gave one example in the supplement in this chapter involving the stability of planetary orbits. This one's not as spectacular as some of the others, but one of the few that can be appreciated without a lot of advanced physics that shows that if the Newtonian formula for gravity involved an inverse cube or more relation, that no planetary orbits would be stable. Planets would all either spiral directly into the sun or go off into far space, and obviously planets that can't maintain a reasonable distance from the sun could never support any kind of life. So that's the kind of thing we're talking about, and it's not controversial. It's well established.
And that was the kind of thought experiment that I mentioned earlier that I found enjoyable as I read your book. And that's a very good point, Dr. Sewell. I mean, it's amazing that intelligent design faces so much opposition in biology, but in physics, the notion that the universe is finely tuned and that there are these anthropic coincidences that have to be explained to account for life, I mean, that's not even very controversial. Would you agree with that statement?
It's not controversial that the conditions are very finely tuned. We have some physicists that don't like the idea of design that hypothesize that there are many universes that we can talk about later, but certainly that the laws of physics are fine-tuned for life is not a controversial statement at all.
Well, you make a good point in your book that I think is rarely mentioned. You state that there are different categories of parameters that are necessary to have life, namely that, quote, scientists modeling the Big Bang have discovered that a universe capable of supporting life requires not only finely tuned laws, but also initial conditions which are astronomically improbable, unquote. We often hear about the fine-tuning of the laws of nature, but what are some of the initial conditions of the universe that also have to be tightly constrained in order to get life?
Well, this is not my area of expertise. I just basically report what the experts who have done this kind of modeling tell us. And again, it's not controversial. It's well known that not only are the laws of physics fine-tuned, but the initial conditions are extremely fine-tuned. I mean, here we're not talking about one part in a thousand, but one part in a gazillion. And for example, the uniformity of the density of matter, if the matter in the early universe were distributed just a very tiny bit more uniformly, no stars would have formed. You can look this up in most any book on cosmology and get some list of some of the issues regarding the fine-tuning of the initial conditions.
Now, you mentioned the multiverse hypothesis a few minutes ago, and in your book you challenge it by saying that the universe isn't just hospitable to life, but that it is lush to life. And can you explain perhaps what you mean here?
And I actually took this term from Behe's The Edge of Evolution. He's the one that, as far as I know, coined this term. And he wasn't suggesting that the universe is extremely friendly to life in the sense that it is popping up all over, that the universe is green with life, lush with life. Rather, that the fundamental laws of physics not only make life possible, but they make it interesting. And he gives some examples. I mentioned, for example, the heavier elements such as iron, copper, and uranium, which are probably not necessary for life. The properties of these elements, which are also fine-tuned, make technology progress possible.
You said that you try to refute the multiverse hypothesis by saying that it forces us to allow for some implausible possibilities, such as Elvis kicking his drug habit, becoming a politician, and then being elected president. But these days, I honestly don't find that sort of thing very hard to believe anymore, that Elvis could actually become president of the United States. So is there something perhaps a little bit more outlandish that we'd have to allow for under the multiverse hypothesis?
I think you're making a joke here that the idea of a rock star becoming president is not so far-fetched anymore. But this is actually a quote from Fred Herring. Let me give you the original quote. It says, "If there are enough universes, one of them would be exactly like ours, except that in this one, Elvis Presley kicked his drug habit, became involved in Tennessee politics, and went on to become president of the United States." The point is not exactly what happens, but the absurdity of the idea that there's another universe that's exactly like ours, well, exactly like ours, period, or exactly like ours, except such and such. You know, it's change the story if you don't like Elvis. Let's change it to if there are enough universes, one of them would be exactly like ours, except in that one, that Casey Luskin didn't ask that Bramble Soul about this quote.
Fair enough, fair enough. Maybe that's more likely than Elvis becoming president. I don't know. Well, you write in your book that, quote, "According to the picture drawn by the popular media, primitive man attributed many phenomena in nature to design, but science has progressively removed the need for the design hypothesis from these phenomena one by one, and now a group of religious fanatics is trying to make a last stand in biological origins where things are most difficult to explain," unquote. I couldn't agree with you more. We see this stereotype in the media all the time. So in your view, Dr. Sewell, why is this stereotype wrong, and why do you think the media promotes it so much?
Well, I said earlier that the fine-tuning of the laws of physics and the initial conditions is not a secret among physicists. It's widely known, many publications about it. You can read about it in any physics text on cosmology. But it does seem to be sort of a secret in the rest of the world. For some reason, it's not a topic that's discussed on many PBS science specials. So for some reason, it's not widely known, despite the fact that it's not controversial. And I guess a lot of people in the media and elsewhere just aren't aware of it.
Fair enough. Well, let's close this podcast up with one final question about beginnings. You write that, quote, "The connection between mathematics and the sciences is truly astounding and points to a common designer." What connections do you see between mathematics and the sciences, and why do they point to a designer?
In Chapter 2, I talk in some length about the Schrödinger equation, which is called the fundamental equation of chemistry. It's the equation that governs the behavior of the basic atomic particles subject to the basic forces of physics. This equation is a partial differential equation with a complex-valued solution. And by complex-valued, I don't mean complicated. I mean involving solutions that are complex numbers, A plus BI, which is extraordinary that the governing equation, basic equation of physics, of chemistry, is a partial differential equation with complex-valued solution. There's absolutely no reason why the basic particles should obey such equation that I can think of, except that it results in elements and chemical compounds with extremely rich and useful chemical properties. In fact, I don't think anyone familiar with quantum mechanics, or not many, would believe that we're ever going to find a reason why it should obey such an equation. They just do. So we have this basic, really elegant mathematical equation, partial differential equation, which is my field of expertise. that governs the most basic particles of nature, and there's absolutely no reason why that anyone knows of why it does. It just does. British physicist Sir James Jean said, "From the intrinsic evidence of his creation, the great architect of the universe begins to appear as a pure mathematician." So God is a mathematician too.
Well, Dr. Sewell, we're really excited about your new book, In the Beginning, and other essays on intelligent design. On the next podcast, we'll move away from cosmic origins and start talking more about biological origins and the evolution of life. In the meantime, if our listeners want to learn more about your book, they can go to the website discoveryinstitutepress.com. That's discoveryinstitutepress.com and browse, and there will be a whole page on your book. And we really appreciate the great work that you've done and for publishing this wonderful book with Discovery Institute Press.
Thank you.
I'm Casey Luskin with ID the Future. Stay tuned for more with Dr. Granville Sewell on his new book, In the Beginning, and other essays on intelligent design.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.